Strange, Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks, written and read by Richard Strange, episode 31. It was a fascinating time to be living in Berlin. Every day there was an incident, a rumour or a scandal. Germany was a society in flux, and there was never any shortage of topics to write about. The British have a soft spot for Berlin, which, thanks to the work of Isherwood and Auden and Spender, occupies a place in the British psyche unlike that of any other city. We love its perceived naughtiness and its perversity, but because we are an inherently prudish race, we like to glimpse it voyeuristically and from a distance. I quickly learned that if I could hang any sort of story on any peg of sex, violence or resurgent Nazism, I would find a paper waiting to print it. Unsurprisingly, those stories were not hard to find in Berlin at that time.
Caroline says, as she gets up off the floor, why is it that you beat me? It isn't any fun. Caroline says, as she makes up her eye, you ought to learn more about yourself. Think more than just I.
In the 2 years that I was semi-resident there, I was enthralled by the variety and the vitality of life. One thing is immediately clear. Berlin is not a typical German city, just as New York is not a typical American town. Berliners, like New Yorkers, are proud and independent. For many Brits, Berlin conjures up images of the decadence of the 20s and 30s, and with a little imagination, you can catch a whiff of those heady times. Try wandering around the Nollendorfplatz area of Schöneberg. Half close your eyes and you half expect to bump into Mr. Isivu on his way to give an English lesson, or Sally Bowles hurrying to meet a wealthy admirer. My friend, the art dealer James Birch, was a welcome visitor to Berlin while I was there. He was in Berlin to buy a Trabi, one of those old East German motor cars made out of reconstituted cardboard and fibre, which were driven by an engine similar to that of a lawnmower. They came in a variety of colours, all of them repulsive, and could be picked up for a song. In 15 minutes he bought the car from a woman who'd waited 15 years to sell it. It was not the first exotic form of transport that James had brought back from the former Soviet Union. A year or two earlier, he'd towed a decommissioned Soviet MiG fighter aircraft all the way from Moscow to London. And when asked by a customs official at Dover if he had anything to declare, he replied, no. A maverick and an adventurer, James organised a Francis Bacon show in Moscow in 1988, took Gilbert and George there in 1990, and emboldened by the experience, he took Gilbert and George to China in 1993. Throughout my stay in Berlin, visitors such as James were always valuable sources of London gossip and entertainment. The artist Richard Wilson, creator of the wonderful 2050 oil piece in the installation Nisarchi collection, came to stay in Berlin for a year on a DAAD, that's his Deutsche Akademische Austauschdienst Foundation bursary, a reciprocal exchange scheme for artists and academics between the UK and Germany. He arrived with his partner and their son, and he was a very welcome addition to the Berlin art scene. A lively and flamboyant couple who I'd known separately through their appearances as performance artists in my clubs in the 80s, their parties became an eagerly anticipated monthly event. In the space of a couple of years, Damien Hirst, Rachel White-Reed, Richard Wentworth and Harlan Miller all followed Wilson to Berlin, courtesy of the charitable arts body, the DAAD, to work in that exciting environment for a year. While my journalism ensured that there was some money coming in while I was not acting, I knew that the principal source of my income would continue to be films and television in the UK. I needed to do some mathematics. I had to work out how many castings I went to in an average year, how many jobs I got, and how much I earned. I could then average out how much each casting earned, whether I got the job or not. For example, if I went to 100 castings in a year and earned £40,000 in an average year, then even if I only got one in five of the jobs I went to castings for, I could calculate that on average each casting earned me £400. Further, if a return flight from Berlin to London cost £140 or so, then the math suggested then it was worth me flying to London to go to any casting that Michel happened to set up, so long as the job was for a minimum £400. Consequently, I got to know the departure lounge at Berlin Tegel Airport pretty well, and I was saying hello and goodbye to the German as regularly as an overtrained parrot at a welcome inn. When I was back in London, I knew that I had to find a flat, and Louisa Buck came to my rescue. She told me that her dad, Sir Anthony Buck, the Conservative MP for Colchester North at that time, sometimes known as the Silent Knight because he hadn't made a speech in the House for so long, he had a small house in Kennington that he would not be needing for a while, as he had recently taken up with a Spanish courtesan named Bienvenida. Sir Anthony had vacated the tiny house in Kennington and moved into Bienvenida's St. John's Wood pad. All he really wanted was someone to move in and maintain it and pay the council tax and the rent that he was being charged. In effect, I was house-sitting for him, but the arrangement suited me fine. It was a small but pretty house within easy reach of both the West End and my family. Louisa arranged a meeting at the house with Sir Ant. We signed a very basic contract over a bottle of claret, and I was in within a week. He explained that he didn't expect to need the house back in the foreseeable future and that I should treat the place as my own. After we left, Louisa advised me not to be too sure about how long I would have the place, as this Bienvenida was a bit of a loose cannon. I moved some clothes and personal effects into the house, and for Rini it was at least the start of a real process of separation. It was also good for me to be able to slip back and forth between Berlin and London without having to make lots of arrangements with other people. No sooner had I moved in than the news of Sir Anne's liaison dangereuse with Bienvenida started to fill the gossip columns. This had the unpleasant and unwelcome effect of attracting grubby little men with cameras and notepads to my doorstep at the crack of dawn, till lights out, in the hope of getting a story or a shot of the star-crossed lovers. Soon afterwards, proving, if proof were needed, that there's no fool like an old fool, Sir Ant had married the blonde Spanish waif, and the alchemical wedding changed Lady Muck into Lady Buck. Everything went well for the first few months, as Hello magazine followed other publications with even less intellectual pretensions in and out of the Buck House boudoir. Tom Dew Matthews, Louisa's beau, was writing a book called Censored about censorship in the British film industry, and asked if he could move his computer into one of the rooms to get him away from the Childfield home to work each day. He was a model co-worker, with only the Hiroshima-like clouds of wacky-backy smoke emanating from his room causing any friction between us. He came every day and stayed for 6 hours and was always happy to take a break to chat about this or that film, producer or director. His knowledge of the subject is extraordinary, yet he wears his knowledge so lightly and with such modesty that you have to drag it out of him. With his silvering temples, grey eyes and dimpled chin, he looks like a cross between Kilroy and Christopher Walken. Women find him irresistibly attractive and he pretends not to notice. Over the next 4 months, his fascinating and unique study of British taboos and prejudices took shape. I often thought he wasn't working fast enough and was rolling too many spliffs or enjoying our exchanges more than he ought, but in fact, he got the book finished in pretty good time and it was well received. By now, I was getting a lot of commissions from publications as diverse as The Guardian, The European, Artline, The Face and Blitz magazines, and I wrote stories on anything from the weekly jumble sales held at the former Stasi headquarters in East Berlin to picaresque snapshots of Berlin nightlife, plus pieces on architecture, music and food. I enjoyed hunting down new angles for stories and keeping an eye or ear open for local gossip. I overheard two young British squaddies discussing in a bar that the Russians were finally pulling out of their garrison in Karlshorst in the eastern part of town. That afternoon, I was there with camera and notepad, to try and intercept some of the shy young conscripts as they clambered aboard the personnel carrier to head home. Many of them seemed less than enthusiastic about heading back to Murmansk or Irkutsk, just when life in East Berlin was about to become fun. A week afterwards, I was back in the same deserted barracks to watch a Vivian Westwood catwalk show, where she was previewing her spring collection to the wide-eyed, bright young things of the Berlin fashion world. Michelle was at this time getting me a lot of work, mainly television and commercials, which meant a lot of flying between Berlin and London. One evening in December back in London, I had dinner at Brian Clark's house, and the musician and TV presenter Jules Holland was one of a dozen or so guests. After we had eaten, Jules announced that he wanted to show us some slides he had taken a few days previously of a hilarious day that he'd spent recording a television programme, The Tube, I think. He set up Brian's slide projector on a screen and proceeded to show us 20 or so slides of only moderate entertainment value. Emboldened by alcohol, I threw down a challenge. I said, "Jules, that was a real disappointment of a show. I hereby declare that my typical day beats yours hands down for entertainment value. I challenge you to nominate a date in the not-too-distant future, and everyone here will record the day in pictures. We will all reconvene here the following week to show our slides and settle the matter once and for all." Jules picked up the gauntlet and nominated a date a week or so later, which we would all record. Now, it just so happened I'd been offered a job working with John Cleese on a series of commercials for a Norwegian chocolate bar called Relax. The commercials called for me to put Cleese to death in a variety of gruesome ways, by guillotine, by firing squad, by hanging, by nailing to a telegraph pole. In each scenario, just at the point of death, an unseen hand or act of God would save Cleese from certain extinction, and he would turn to the camera and with that most obsequious Basil Fawlty grin, he would exhort the viewer to relax. The filming took place over 3 days, and the second of which was Jules' nominated day. I got on very well with Cleese on the first day, although he tended towards tetchiness if he was in an uncomfortable position too long, and didn't suffer fools or make-up girls gladly. Between takes with a cup of tea, he was charm itself. He is, as is well known, a very intelligent, very serious man off camera, but we shared enough interest to enjoy each other's company in those long periods where nothing much seemed to be happening. I told him about the challenge I'd made to Jules, and he found the whole notion of competitive days very funny. I asked him if he would object if I photographed the following day's filming, and he was positively encouraging. The next morning, I arrived at the studios with my camera and a large wall clock, which I decided I would feature in each picture to illustrate the sequence of events. As we progressed through the day, I would frequently grab the clock, get John to hold it in some alarming near-death pose, and have someone photograph the two of us. As the day went on, John was clearly enjoying the shots we did together rather more than the shots we were doing for the commercial, and we set up ever-increasingly ludicrous tableaus around the guillotine or the chopping block. The same imagination that had ignited the best moments of the absurdist humour in Monty Python, 40 Towers or The Life of Brian was mine to use in the pursuit of a slideshow victory over Jules. On my way home from the shoot as a final bonus, I drove down the Strand and saw a fire next to Somerset House, with smoke billowing from a window and half a dozen fire engines outside. I pulled up, grabbed my camera and asked a fireman in full apparatus if he'd mind holding the large wall clock for a moment. He looked bewildered but kindly obliged and posed with the clock heroically before the blaze. I thought, victory is mine. Sadly, Holland, sensing imminent defeat, has never managed to agree on a date for the great mass screening. My slides remain in a locked safe in case of subterfuge. Back in Kennington, Louisa warned me that all was not well with Sir Anton Bienvenida in Buck House, and that I should be prepared for the worst. It was only when the Jaguar needed repairing, and both hoped that the other would be able to pick up the bill, that things started to go awry. At the garage, when the bill was presented, they stood side by side, each hoping that the other would blink and say, "Oh, don't worry, darling, I'll pay for this." After what seemed like an eternity, Sir Ant did the decent thing and coughed up. It must have been a terrible shock for both of them to realise that neither of them was actually loaded. Although theirs was clearly a love match forged in heaven, the more mundane requirements of life on Earth had started to drive a wedge between Sir Ant and Lady Buck. A week later, I was woken at 2 a.m. by someone knocking on my front door. I had no idea who would come calling at that hour and threw up the window to ask who it was. There on my threshold stood the forlorn figure of Sir Ant, wispy white haired, blown ragged by the winter wind, and a plastic carrier bag in each hand. I went down to let him in, and he told me the sad story. "Oh, B and I have had a bit of a bust-up," he confessed. "Marvellous girl and all that. It'll all blow over in a couple of days. Thing is, old boy, I need somewhere to crash for a couple of days. Do you mind if I take the old spare room?" What could I say? I poured him a drink and listened to his tale of woe, put him to bed, and the next day I knew I would be flat hunting again. I've been one half of several odd couples in my time, but this was not about to be one of them. I quickly managed to find another flat to use as a base, again in the Kennington Oval area. In Berlin, I covered the Berlin. In May, I did a film with Gavin Miller. Look at it this way. This time I was playing an animal rights activist, and I had to do a couple of scenes with a real lion that I was liberating from a circus. On the day the beast arrived on location, albeit a rather moth-eaten specimen in a semi-tranquilized state, I was taken with Gavin to be briefed by the animal's handler. He was a self-important, weaselly man in an anorak with an irritating nasal delivery.
"The first thing I have to say," he began, "is that these animals can and do kill."
This particular specimen looked like he could barely meow convincingly, but I took the handler's word.
"In case of an emergency, I will be standing by with a tranquilizer dart."
This instilled a short-lived sense of security in me.
"However," he whined on with all the communication skills of a British Rail announcer, "the tranquilizer dart takes 15 minutes to take effect on the creature."
I didn't reckon my chances of survival after a 15-minute mauling from a kitten, let alone from a lion, so I suggested helpfully, "If there is an emergency, could you use the gun on me first so I don't feel any pain?" He didn't laugh. Having survived the lion and the far more serious threat of death by boredom from its keeper, the German and I headed to Malaysia for a holiday together. We went to the east coast to Kuantan and Tanjung Jara, stayed in the most perfect hotel and unwound in total serenity for 10 days. I liked Malaysia, its people, its topography, its climate, and especially the food. But to have stayed there for more than 10 days would have had me peeling the walls. It's a little bit boring, it must be said. When the German returned to work in Berlin, I headed straight to London, where I knew that my old friend Duncan Ward, the smooth, chiselled and wholly unreliable South African, was starting to put a film project together. He was making a short, absurdist film called Dead Men Don't Remember. Since I liked Duncan and knew that the film would be an enjoyable and a different experience than the run-of-the-mill, I agreed to take part.
Everybody's up for sale. The poets, the politicians, everybody has their price, after all. Do you wanna buy the latest dream? Do you wanna buy a new tradition? Do you wanna buy another piece of this wall? Is this the brave new? the start of the waiting game. Brave new world. Oh, is this the waiting game? Becomes a sense of place. Just like with willing automatic hands, full of body, full of burning limo, but only sometime later recognize the face. Is this the brave new world? Or the start of the waiting game?